The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this July 29th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes, Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher. We are other podcast platforms, however you consume your podcasts. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these days. I'm spending the hour this morning talking about novelist Megha Majumdar's stunning debut, A Burning, published by Knopf. Megha was born and raised in Calcutta, India. She moved to the United States to attend college at Harvard University, followed by graduate school in social anthropology at Johns Hopkins. She works as an editor at Catapult and joins me from her home in Brooklyn. Megha, welcome.
Hi, Marie. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. This was unbelievable. I love that Mother Jones was talking about this as a thriller for the least summery summer we've ever had. I thought that was perfect.
Very apt.
Very apt. So because we have the luxury of time, I was thinking that maybe we could start by talking a little bit about your childhood and experience growing up in India. I think it was during the 1990s. And just, you know, kind of tell us a little bit about what that was like and if you noticed kind of parallels from that time of growing up to kind of what we've been seeing over here for the past 4 to 6 years, or just kind of take us into your childhood world a little bit.
I had a pretty ordinary childhood, you know. Summer, I've been actually thinking about summers at home, and I've been thinking back to the great freedom of leaving school for the day in the afternoon and coming out and having your orange ice cream and chatting with your friends and getting on the bus and all of those textures and images and those pleasures, which I think stay with me so powerfully as, you know, people's childhood memories do. I was always encouraged to read what I wanted to, so one of my favorite things to do was to go with my parents' used bookstores, which were really no more than stacks of books on the sidewalk. And I would read Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys and Agatha Christie. And I loved reading travel stories. So I was always free to read very widely. And I have been thinking about how much those readings have filtered into the way that I write now. I think they were certainly very formative in terms of thinking about storytelling and suspense and movement.
Very cool. And you, at what age did you start studying English in India?
Oh, I was very little. Kindergarten age, I don't remember.
Yeah.
How old I was exactly, but I really struggled to learn English the first year that I applied to schools after kindergarten. I actually didn't get in anywhere because my English was so poor. And then I had to go to these special English coaching classes to brush up on my English. And I use foreign language. My mother tongue is Bengali. And it was a language that I always felt was very completely unknown to me. And so I struggled with it. But I think as soon as I started reading, you know, and started reading fairy tales and Cinderella and that kind of thing, folk tales, as soon as I started reading, it became a place of pleasure for me.
It's always interesting to me to talk to writers who, bilingual, trilingual writers, the depth that it adds to their writing because, you know, that there's just a wider playground, I feel like, with language, that you have access to all these other idioms and all these other ways of, you know, lenses of looking through the world, separate and apart from, you know, just being constrained by one language. And even if you're writing in just one language, you can bring all of that material into this. I think that would be so fun. I don't have that advantage.
I mean, yeah, I think that is so right. Part of what I hope is present in my English is the capacity that my mother tongue Bengali has for humor and sentiment and pathos. So I hope that even though it is invisible in my English, I hope it adds depth and richness to the language that I know.
It does. It totally does. And yeah, like you say, I think it's not invisible. I think it's, you know, it's kind of like an artist who's, you know, they have the sketch in the background and they paint over it and paint over it and paint over it. But whatever that is under it is still there, you know, and I feel like that was present in this book as well. We can get into that in a little bit.
It's a beautiful way of putting it.
Yeah, it was so lovely, but we'll get to that. The last thing that I wanted to ask before we get to all of that, I love this decision to go into social anthropology because it strikes me that no better degree is out there for a writer than social anthropology. And, you know, I was wondering if you entered that degree with an eye for writing or, you know, if you thought about the MFA route in that kind of traditional way or tell me a little bit about your experience with that degree and what it's done for your work.
Oh, well, can I ask if you studied anthropology as well?
No, I was a lawyer. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. well, I really appreciate your enthusiasm for anthropology. I did not know what anthropology was when I started college, and I realized that all of the classes that I was taking happened to be in the anthropology department. So that's kind of how I started thinking about what anthropology was. For me, when I started college in the US, coming from the Indian education system, I was just greedy to learn a lot, you know? All of my first year classes were, you know, studies of Russian borderlands and South American politics. And at the time, Darfur was in the news. I remember taking a class on Darfur. So I was just greedy to learn about all of these other parts of the world. And anthropology is all about other people's perspectives. It's about this kind of bottom-up, ground-level, intimate study of what it is like to be a different person in a particular situation. So I was really drawn to that, to the way in which anthropology allows you to look at political issues, issues in community, with great attention to complexity and nuance and surprise. And you are so right that all of those elements are essential elements in a fiction writer's toolkit. So I didn't really plan it that way. I thought for a while that I wanted to work in human rights and development, and that's kind of realized that I would have my best and strongest impact by working in the world of books.
Yes. And there's a really interesting observation in this book, and we can get into that as well, about the impact of books, whether books have an impact, whether words have an impact. And, you know, I was wondering if, as you were setting out making this decision to move away from human rights and kind of tangible work with people into the world of books, what your feeling is about that. If you feel like there's a lot of social cause or justice to be served through fiction, what fiction can and can't do. Just your thoughts about the role of books in a world that we're living through right now.
You know, it's very strange because I grew up as a reader, of course, and since I was a kid, people would call me a bookworm and I would always go to family gatherings with a book in hand and that kind of thing. But I was also very aware that there are people for whom books don't do anything. You know, I would go to school and out the window of the school bus, you'd see kids my age who were washing dishes at the roadside. You know, they worked at these roadside little restaurants, or you would go to a tailor's shop and behind the tailor, there would be his apprentices who were just kids learning to make clothes. So I think I was very aware early on that as much as I love books and love reading, it's an act of great privilege. And of course, I didn't have this language back then, but I knew that there were kids who were not going to school and kids who were not on this path of studying in books. So I have always been very aware of the limitations of fiction. You know, I hope that this book is some kind of, is an act of offering a complex narrative. But fiction is not activism. Fiction has its limits. So those are two kind of contradictory things that I hold within me, that love of books, that sense for how valuable they are and how necessary I think they are. And at the same time, the knowledge that fiction has not changed people's lives in the way that we would like to imagine. And there are people for whom books have done nothing.
Yeah, I love hearing your perspective on that, because I think, you know, especially in the last couple of months as I'm talking to writers about how they're thinking and they're working and creativity, you know, I think a lot of people are feeling so impotent kind of in what they should be doing and asking themselves these questions about, you know, what's it all for, Alfie? And, you know, I think it's an important question to be, or conversation to be had. And I think the level of complexity of it is really interesting, and to acknowledge both sides of that coin, I think is really important as well.
What do you think? I mean, you're a lawyer, so your engagement with books, and of course, it's clear that, you know, you're a careful and devoted reader of fiction as well. So like, what do you think?
Well, first, I'll say, thank God I had to give up the, or, you know, I got to give up the law, years and years ago. So, that I'm a lawyer by training, but, the conversation that I've been having and I think is giving me hope is that fiction can reach people in a way that nonfiction can't, because, nonfiction's a little self-selecting, right? You kind of know what you're going to get when you pick it up. And so the audience is a bit of an echo chamber, but fiction, it feels like, isn't as much. And so you can take maybe a reader that wouldn't be so, sympathetic to your point of view into a very empathetic situation and allow them to experience the complexity viscerally as opposed to intellectually. And, you know, maybe that can change a mind, hopefully.
But I really love that.
Who knows? Who knows? What do we have but hope, right? So take us into the book for readers that may not have picked it up. It came out at the beginning of June, so maybe a lot of readers have already gotten to it. But if they have not, I'd love for you to introduce us to this world, to these three amazing people, and kind of lay the groundwork, and then we can jump off and talk about it.
Yeah. A Burning is a novel about three characters who are chasing big dreams while the society around them makes this dangerous turn toward right-wing nationalism. And I can speak really quickly about the three characters if you like.
Definitely. Go ahead.
There's a central character who is a young woman who all she wants is to rise to the middle class, keep her job at a mall, enjoy her new smartphone, but she gets into big trouble because of a politically risky comment that she makes on Facebook. The second main character is a school teacher who feels that he's not really having the kind of vigorous impact on the nation that he might have dreamed of. And he gets drawn into the workings of this right-wing political party. The third main character is a person who is on the very margins of Indian society in really complex ways. And from that place, she chases a wild dream. She goes to weekly amateur acting classes in order to pursue her big ambition of being a movie star.
So tell me where the original kernel of the idea came from, and if the finished product of the book bears pretty close relationship to what the original idea was, or if it really changed a lot in the course of the writing.
I knew that I wanted to write a book that would say something, ask something about how people live within oppressive systems. So I was very clear on what the story was that I wanted to tell. And then, of course, once you start writing, you have to make all of these decisions. So I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, how the book would end and that kind of thing, which I hadn't pinned down when I started. So in those elements, I kind of came to them through the
writing. So, you know, I really loved all three of these characters. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how you got to know them, and if they, you know, if these three were always the three that it was going to be, if you played around with maybe, you know, characters who didn't make it into the final cut, but kind of how you got to know them and who may have given you the most difficulty in getting to know them.
That's a great question. I think I always knew that it was going to be these three characters because they came out of specific questions and aims that I had. But I think there was a moment of despair where I felt that I could only write three arcs and three stories with any depth and insight. And so I was sad that I couldn't write more than three and really do them any justice. So that's kind of why the book also has these short chapters called interludes, which are just kind of leaving the door ajar for a reader to look at a minor character's life for just a page or two. And that was my way of gesturing toward how in this world, there are really so many rich stories. The interludes were my way of gesturing toward the fact that there were all of these rich stories that a person could follow.
I love how at some point you said, I wanted to be the book to be an act of invitation to open imaginative doors to many different complex stories. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly what these interludes did, that you could take one of these characters and sort of spin out in your own mind what their life must be like, even though they didn't have, you know, a lot of page time. You were really able to render so much in so little. I mean, the novel is so complex and rich, and the depth of the characters, and yet really very short in some ways. And I went back as I was reading it a second time and marveled at how much you were able to accomplish in a relatively, you know, not compressed, but economic period of time, which led me to wonder if you studied or are interested in poetry and how you kind of were able to capture so much in so little space.
Oh, I don't think I've been asked about poetry before. Sadly, I have not studied poetry, and I don't write poetry, but that's really beautiful. I think the thing that I was very conscious of is the book makes a claim upon a reader's time, you know? A book is really saying, well, spend, I don't know, 6 hours with me of your scarce leisure time. So I was very conscious of the kind of reward that I wanted this book to offer. I wanted it to be a book that would say something intellectually serious, but also a book that you could come home after a full day at work or school or doing research and you could pick it up and it would have the same kind of entertainment and immersiveness and fun that a really good TV show might. And I wanted to see if I could do that. I did not want any wasted or baggy pages. I wanted that sense of velocity and pace and swiftness so that you're just turning the pages. And then when the book is over, hopefully the book leaves you thinking about some things.
Well, you totally accomplished that. That is no question, you accomplished all of that. I loved how you got into it too, because as at the very beginning, what starts with, you know, what is kind of a very dramatic terrorist attack. This train is sort of torched, you know, kind of a Molotov cocktail torching of this train. And it feels like it would have been easy to start literally with that scene, you know, that it's a very cinematic sort of visual scene. And yet it starts in a quieter moment. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about finding your way into the story. And I also love that the image at the very beginning had, and I won't give anything away, had a bit of a payoff at the very end as well. It was a very nice bookending with that opening and closing image of our character. So talk a little bit about finding the right opening, if that was always the beginning, and kind of how you knew that was the way to get into this book and this character.
You know, it's so funny that you ask, because I think for a while, my opening was a separate scene which goes into the attack on the train. And I think I had a little bit from the perspectives of the people on the train. But this is something that my really brilliant editor at Knopf, Jordan Pavlin, helped work with. Is there was something missing in that opening of the train. It kind of felt like a false beginning, where the book would begin with the train and then begin again introducing you to the main character. And I think we felt that much as we loved the drama of the train, perhaps we wanted to begin with introducing the character and putting her in relation to the train. And I guess the other thing that went into that was there is a scene of violence much, much later in the book. And I felt like any violence in the book had to feel really necessary. And really, like, the reader, when they came to that visual, would understand why it needed to be there, would understand the world unfurling around that act of violence. So I felt that having a different act of violence so early in the book and centering it in this dramatic way was perhaps not the best way to begin.
Really interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had ever played around with having the attack itself being the opening, and then as you're talking about it, understanding that the real key behind this book is the character and the character study, and so understanding the character first, set up against the backdrop of what happens to that character, should be at the forefront. And I thought that was a really nice lesson for writers, you know, that maybe the drama shouldn't take first step out of the gate, and character filtered through the drama is what really needs to be put at the forefront. I thought that was kind of a nice writing lesson in real time there.
Yeah. I mean, can I ask, you write both fiction and nonfiction, is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, not at the level you're doing, but, you know, yes, I love the short story form. So I've really played around a lot with the short story form. That's my favorite.
So you're somebody who's always thinking about openings. How do you arrive? Like, what do you look for in your openings?
It is. It's hard. That's why I ask writers all the time. I think openings and closing, especially in short stories, is really complicated. Mm-hmm. And short stories, I think, are often character driven. I mean, it's really, you know, it's not going to be a big plot action thriller, right? So yeah, that opening, knowing what's at stake early on. And I loved the idea that all three of these characters, I forget which interview it was, but somebody made the observation that what all three of these characters really want is likes, you know, at the basic foundation, that's what they all want. But it was really wonderful. And another wonderful writing lesson, I think, you know, we're often asked as writers, you know, what does your character want? And sometimes what they say they want is not really what they want. But here it was really very explicit, and what they said they wanted really was what they wanted. And I thought, you know, kind of being explicit with what their desires were, and, you know, this tangible, every page going after what they are, even at the expense of each other, was was really wonderful. And I wondered if, as you were sketching these characters out, kind of what your sketches of them looked like. Like, did you keep notebooks of these characters' lives and backgrounds and what they looked like? And kind of tell me a little bit about exploring who they were and you getting to know them.
Well, this is something I want to hear from you about too, but I'll go first. The characters, I had three different documents for the three characters, and I mostly wanted to make sure that I was writing each character with complexity. That was the most important thing to me, is to not write flat or simplistic characters. I wanted to write characters who would have moments of generosity and moments of selfishness and moments where they acted, you know, in the moral way and moments where they perhaps made questionable choices. And I wanted to give them room to have all of that. And I wanted to give them room to make jokes and tease others and have fun. So that complexity was really important to me. I did feel that, I know that some writers write around their characters a lot, like you were saying, you know, writing what their lives are like and what their backgrounds might have been. I have never done that exercise. I wonder how it would change my writing if I did. But the other thing that was important to me was that I have enough there so that the reader can form the other half of the character in their head. So I am not a huge fan of a lot of physical description, for example, because I feel that I need a few key details. And once I have those elements in place, once I give these people emotional dimensions, then a reader can kind of imagine what these people might look like for them. How do you sketch out your characters beyond who they will be on the page?
No, that's why I always ask. No, I don't. You know, I think the exciting part of characters is taking some kernel of whatever is within you that you understand this person. You know, I kind of think of these, of characters as sort of a broken mirror on the bathroom floor, and there's some shard of one of them that must bear some relationship to you. Mm. And then taking that, you know, little shard of whatever kernel is in you and spinning it out into this whole other individual with their own agency and their own desires. And I think that's the fun part. It's also the very hard part. You know, I think it's very complicated.
It is so hard. But I really like what you're saying about, you know, kind of seeing yourself, but in a slanted way, in a different way, and just a part of it. And then you can kind of grow a new person from that element.
And it's interesting because a lot of writers tell me that the characters that are the most difficult to render are the ones who are autobiographically closest to them. Those are the ones that really give them the hardest time. And the further away they can get from their own biography, kind of the easier it gets to imagine these other worlds and other lives. And I think that's interesting too. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Megha Majumdar. The book we are talking about is A Burning. I loved Lovely. She's a wonderful character. She seems like she's intersex. Tell me her little, in Indian culture, she has kind of this wonderful and complicated standing where she is looked upon as someone who can, with kind of mystical characteristics as well as marginalized characteristics. And talk a little bit about that and how the restraint you used so that that idea and that aspect of her didn't overwhelm the plot as I felt like it could have.
Lovely is a character who belongs to the Hijra community, which is a very particular Indian social category at the intersection of gender and religion and, very importantly, class, and believed to have a close connection to the divine. So she is welcomed to weddings to bless couples who are getting married. And if there's a home in the neighborhood where there's a newborn, she's invited there to bless the baby. But at the same time, like you pointed out, she's also looked down upon and reviled. She makes a living begging on the streets and on trains. So it's this very complex place of marginalization. And I wanted to write about a character who really feels the full might of this state's oppressive and discriminatory systems from this place of great oppression, refuses to accept these conditions. She's someone who pushes back on the shame that this society wants to burden her with, and she chases this big dream. You know, she chases, I think, the wildest possible dream of being a movie star and having a starring role in the movies. And she does this with so much diligence and devotion. And she also lives with so much humor. She's constantly teasing others. She's making jokes about them. And I wanted that spirit and that joy and defiance in the book.
She's so wonderful because she's sort of a tour guide through the city streets, you know. India is its own character in the book. And for the average American who hasn't had the pleasure of going, she really felt like you're on the ground, you know, Julie McCoy, to take an old American love boat expression. She felt like your guide through those streets, and you really felt like you were walking beside her and you were spending time with the guava seller. And, you know, there was a scene in here, and I don't want to give so much away, but I will say there's a scene that takes place in a dentist's office that is not functioning as a dentist's office. That's really an explosive scene, but again, doesn't overwhelm the main narrative of the story. It's one of those, I don't think it's told as an interlude, but it is, again, one of those portals into the storyline where you can imagine walking along and you look through this peek hole.
Mm.
You see this whole world going on that's shocking, and then you just move on and now we're back into the storyline. And I wanted to draw attention to your ability, again, to, you know, just tease the reader with the richness and complexity of this culture and these classes without taking away from the forward momentum of the narrative, and how you accomplish that.
Well, you're very kind. I appreciate it. I think that part of my hope for this book is that it leaves a lot of doors open so that any reader can understand that, well, I chose to write about these three characters and focus on these aspects of their lives, but really you could follow anybody else in this world. There are so many stories here that deserve attention. So that was really interesting to me. And, you know, movement in the book, which I'm sure is something that you think about as well, is one thing that was really important to me was to always have movement. And you can have various kinds of movement, right? So like one is that I was moving the narrative forward. I was making, you know, things happen and consequences and choices and so on. So the narrative itself moves forward. But then another kind of movement is when you dig deep into a character's life. And you try to have that kind of downward movement toward the truth of what you want to convey, you know? I think sometimes I find it helpful to think about it in terms of, you know, each sentence has layers and layers below it. Each tinkering and revision of that sentence, you're trying to get to the layer beneath. You're trying to get at what is just under the sentence that you have written? What are you truly trying to say? So that kind of downward digging movement is, I think, where some of those sections that you're talking about came from. But how do you think of movement?
Well, you know, I think I'm trying to learn so much from novelists because it's so much different in a novel, or at least it's so much more complex in a novel, it feels to me, than it is in a short story. And so I'm really interested in this idea of movement as I'm piecing through how you make the leap from short story to novel, because it's so much more essential, you know. And a short story is just this compressed period of time and space where something either explosive or subtle needs to happen, but it's circumscribed a little bit. In a novel, mm-hmm. you can't you just can't do it that way. So I'm really trying to make a study of how this is done. Mm. And you had said something, and I think this is really helpful as well, structurally, that you had one character who has a lot of downward momentum. Her storyline is devolving into despair. And mm-hmm. two characters whose storyline are spinning up. They're slowly achieving what they want while she is slowly losing what she wants. And I thought that was a really interesting structure to put these characters' momentum in opposition to each other, that one is downward moving and two are upward moving. Was that something that was conscious right at the beginning?
I think it was something that I had quite early on. It felt like a good shape for the book. And I think it also helped me ask what I wanted truthfully, which is, you know, how do people not just survive, but how do they move forward through this? And so part of the answer is perhaps, well, they face these systems, they face these institutions, and perhaps sometimes they don't. But equally important is that people do find ways forward. So it felt like a good balance to have that structure.
Do you feel as though, I know that you wanted the book and set out for the book to say something important intellectually and politically, as well as, you know, have these fully rich, realized, funny, humorous, playful characters' lives. Did you feel like there's some sort of job on the part of a writer as artist to make a commentary, or is that ancillary to the job of you as entertainer? Did you feel compelled, I guess, to have a message, or was it a happy ending that it did have that it did turn out to have such a message, and a message that's ringing so interestingly and prophetically in the world that we find ourselves in now?
I think I saw the book as an instrument for really powerfully asking a question. And it's hard to tease out all the different strands of that, because I think sometimes the most forceful way in which to ask a question is to tell a story that feels really entertaining and immersive. It's not to, you know, throw a polemic at you or give you a really dry text which makes its point. So it felt crucial to me that I tell this story well. And if I tell this story well, then maybe it will be able to put forward a question before a reader. I don't really think it's a novelist's job, or I didn't really see it as my job to offer commentary. I think that kind of reflection is something a reader brings, you know, their thoughts, their life is, they bring that to the book.
Right. How many drafts did this go through?
I find it hard to even talk about discrete drafts because I'm constantly rewriting. So every time I come back to the pages, I'm changing something. So it's one long, endless, ever-changing draft. And it's so strange because even now when I pick up the book to read from it, you know, I see so many words and sentences that I would change or edit or cut. So right. It's really endless, and you just have to let it go at some point.
But did you write it from beginning to end as you were, so you were fiddling all the way along, but did you make yourself, force yourself to sit down and do, you know, sort of, I'm starting on page one and I'm working to page 300?
I don't think so. I mean, there were sections where I was always aware of the narrative and how it needs to move forward, and I had to put in the work to make that happen. But I'm sure there were days when I wanted to work on one specific section and skip ahead or move back and revisit something I'd already done. So that kind of movement, I think as long as you're aware that the narrative needs to have shape, it can't be an endless series of, you know, just turning to the parts that you most enjoy.
Yes, I asked that question because it's always a temptation of mine to do that, you know, that I get stuck and then I think, here's a scene that I'd really like to write, so I'm just going to jump to that scene. And it's very easy, I think, to end up with a pile of fragments that are sort of disconnected to each other and now don't have any logical sequence to each other when you, the seduction of, oh, this scene over here is going to be so much fun, so I'm just going to do that. Or I don't know where I'm going. I'm feeling stuck, so I'm just going to get myself out of it by writing this other thing. And it can really, I think, derail the momentum of the plot and the, you know, the important way that the narration has to be stitched together for it to make, you know, kind of narrative sense, that B really does have to follow A, even if you, you know, are totally seduced by what's going to happen, you know, N or Q, you know.
Right. But at the same time, I mean, that's really fun. And I think it's such a good way of moving yourself close to the parts that really matter to you. I wonder if that can actually be a really helpful nudge urging you to look at what it is that you do feel really strongly about in this story and what it is that you want to spend time with.
Yeah. Well, and having three characters' points of view also would give you a little bit of permission to get at, you know, if you're stuck with P.T. Sir and you can spend a little time with Lovely, you just hear her voice stronger that day. It would be nice, I think, to have the freedom to move between characters. And I don't know if you spent, if you could move from one character to the other in the same day, or if you really had to stay in Siobhan's point of view before you could, you know what I mean? If you really had to be immersed in her life, her story, her backstory, and you needed some time, space, mental distance before you moved to one of the other characters.
I'm pretty sure I jumped around, and you're right that, you know, there were days where I felt that I just wanted to stay with one of the characters and really be in their voice and their world. And it was really good to have those options because the three different characters have such different moods as well. So it felt like a good chance to take a break from one and go to another.
It's funny because there were points in the book where I just had to put it down. I could see something coming that I didn't want to happen, and I just couldn't make myself do it at certain points. Yeah. So I found myself putting it down and, you know, having to steel myself to face it again. And I was wondering if you had that experience, if you were like, you know, some bad things are going to happen to good people, or some bad things are going to happen, some good things are going to happen to questionable people, because we're always told to kind of write to the scary parts and write to our greatest fears. And if there were parts of this which were just really hard for you to write.
Part of what I found really helpful was being really hard and relentless on my book. So I think the difficulty was not so much writing some tough consequences for the character or some emotionally dark spaces in the book, as there are spaces of laughter and joking as well. So I think that balanced it out for me. But what was difficult for me was asking those questions of, where am I bored? Where do I want to put this draft down and look at my phone or watch TV, or, you know? So I think really being quite cold with my manuscript and knowing that I don't want to be indulgent with it. It's not play. It's a claim on someone's time. And so I have to be sure that it's not confusing, that the stakes are clear in the opening pages, that there aren't pages where a reader thinks, okay, I'm getting all of these characters and details, but why? Why should I read this? I think the book always had to answer what for me is a hard and absolutely necessary question, which is, why does this book need to exist? Why should a reader spend time with this book? Why should anybody care about this made-up world? So I think those questions felt like tough but really necessary questions.
I was really enjoying the way social media was used in the book, and it made me reflect on how much social media has changed in the U.S. over the past 4 years. You know, we used to just be obsessed with cat videos, and that's kind of what we shared on Facebook. But it obviously here it has become much, much more political. There, I know it was political. And the consequences of social media and our connectedness now, we're seeing the rotten fruit of our tree, I guess, is the best way I can think to put it. And it's interesting. I mean, as I just read yesterday that we're thinking of banning TikTok in this country. or putting mm-hmm. restrictions around it. And I was going to ask you just about your insights into social media and what it has done to both India and the US, how it's shaped our politics and how we relate to each other.
I think social media has allowed so many people to have a platform, have a voice. And I think that is what the character in this book also wants. She wants the freedom to say what she would like and to make a joke on social media. But the thing that I wanted to focus on and think about was also that social media is sometimes seen as this terrain of, you know, free speech, freedom, you can say whatever you want, but that is just not true, right? So for this character, the vulnerabilities that she has in her real life, in her real status in society, those are vulnerabilities that she carries over into social media. So she gets into big trouble for a comment that maybe somebody else might have been okay making. So I wanted to look at this fraught terrain, and also see, of course, you know, the present reality of India, which is that it has a huge population that is just now getting access to the internet and just becoming social media literate. I think India has the most number of Facebook users in the world. I read this somewhere. So social media is a huge part of current reality, and I wanted to include that.
And this would still be, I assume it's true that this would have been a dangerous act on her part to do in India, which is not yet the case here, but who knows, yeah?
I think so. I mean, anybody reading the news will be aware of, you know, cases where people got in trouble for liking a post or forwarding a meme and stuff like that. So it's not a stretch.
Let's talk a little bit about your work at Catapult before we have to go, and how maybe being an editor either it got in your head, if it helped you as a writer. I imagine it might, but I could also imagine ways that it might get in your head too much and make it hard as a writer. Talk a little bit about that relationship between your editor brain and your writer brain.
I think my editing has really nourished my writing in many ways. You know, as a reader, you read, as an editor, sorry, you read such a huge volume of manuscripts. So you're very attentive to what excites you in a manuscript. You know, what about the pace? What about the structure? What about sentence level surprises is appealing to you? So it gives you something really concrete to strive toward, something to want to achieve in your own writing. So all of the stuff that I was talking about earlier in terms of, you know, asking hard questions about where are you bored? Where are you confused? What are the stakes? Are they clear? All of those questions, I think, have helped me as an editor. I think you're able to see your own writing with the harshness and impatience and boredom, potential boredom of any reader. And that really helps you. You know, I had it in my head always that there are so many good books in the world. Nobody's waiting for my book. Yeah. And, you know, the other part of being an editor is also that you get to work closely with writers whose work you love. You know, you read their books and you think, okay, I have to press it into the hands of everybody that I know and say that they have to read it tomorrow. And that kind of energy is so good. It's so nourishing.
Did you have a lot of readers for this book before it went off to your editor?
I did not have a lot of readers. The only two people who really saw it were my husband and a very close friend of mine with whom I do writing workshops, just the two of us. And then at some stage, I shared it with, I think, a couple more friends when it was really, really done and had legs. So yeah, I kept it pretty quiet and in a space of solitude.
I think that's a really interesting way to do it, because I do feel like too early sharing, too much sharing can really take the energy out of a piece of work, or it can pull you in a direction maybe which isn't the direction you intended for it to go. You know, too early feedback, too much feedback.
I agree.
Yeah, can be kind of a dangerous thing. And what was the time period over which it was written?
I wrote it over 4 years, I think.
Talk a little bit about the agent finding process, if that was really easy, if being at Catapult was sort of a nice platform for you, or if that kind of didn't matter. Tell me a little bit about that publishing process.
Catapult, I acquire largely nonfiction, and I was reaching out to agents who do largely fiction. So I was really glad. I didn't want to make it awkward for my job in any way, but I queried a few agents whose work I love. You know, they have championed incredible writers, and I was really happy for the chance to query them and then have conversations with them. It was a really tough process, you know, and in the end, I'm very happy that I landed with my current agent, who is Eric Simonoff at WME, who is absolutely brilliant and did a lot of craft work with me, which I'm really grateful for.
What craft issues should we have talked about today? Advice that, you know, craft things that sort of either surprised you in what that you learned about in the course of writing this novel, or, you know, things that really served you very well? Is there good advice that we should have mentioned that we didn't?
That is a great question. What did I find helpful? I think we touched on this a little bit, but I never really spoke about the book with people, and I really always saw the book as an act of communication in itself, which I did not be talking about it. I felt that guarding a book's energy was one of the most important things that I did, and perhaps that's helpful to somebody who's also a writer who's listening. Sometimes it can feel really solitary and frustrating, and like this huge important thing in your life is completely hidden from many, many other people in your life. But I would say resisting the temptation to talk about it and bring it into the space of casual conversation, I found very helpful.
Tell me a little bit about what I know it's coming out at such a difficult world time. And I'm wondering if there are any advantages that you've had. I mean, you can't have book tours. You can't have in-person conversations. You can't be in bookstores. You know, the conversations all have to be kind of online. But I was wondering if there was any upside to it coming out when it came out, and if you've, you know, experienced any surprises that, you know, would have been unforeseen if it hadn't been released at the time it was.
It published in a very tough time, so I don't know that I can see any silver linings, but
yeah.
I think one thing that I have been grateful for is the existence of virtual events and how quickly and nimbly bookstores and different organizations switched to doing virtual events. I was very happy that I could do events with really incredible writers. Like, I had events with Nicole Chung and Sumanth Kidd and Madeline Miller and Pam Zhang and Britt Bennett and just so many amazing writers. And maybe that would not have been possible if we had been limited to Sin. But this formation of community, this generosity on their part, that is really special, you know, just to see writers lifting each other up and boosting each other's work and adapting, that has been really encouraging.
Yes. And you have a wonderful website, so we can find all of the virtual events that you're doing. Is that the best way to kind of track you and follow you?
Website, which is my name, meghamajumdar.com. But most current information about events I will be tweeting. So
okay.
If any listeners want to follow me on Twitter, that's probably the best way to keep up with what I'm up to. And my Twitter is at Megha, M-A-J.
You have a new fan. You have a new follower. Megha, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Marie. I really loved this conversation. So thoughtful, so beautiful. Thank you for your care. I'm really grateful.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Have a great, great day.